You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
We are continuing our history series today, taking a look at the Puritan movement with Dr. McKenzie. Thanks to Concordia University, Wisconsin for your support of The Coffee Hour. Find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin at cuw.edu.
Live uncommon.
Joining us again today, the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me again. I'm glad to be back.
We are, it just keeps getting better and better, like the history digging into this. So now we're up to the Civil War. And when I say Civil War, I don't mean in the United States.
Mm-mm. No.
We're still in England. So what happened to the Puritan movement during the Civil War, Dr. McKenzie?
Lots. Let's put it that way. Lots happened to the Puritan movement. I should just kind of do this very quickly for our audience. The war breaks out in 1642 between the Parliament and the king. By 1646, the king has basically lost the war. He becomes a prisoner of the Parliament. In 1648, there's a coup, and in 1649, the king is executed. So we have a period of time in English history when there is no king. Sometimes that's just called the interregnum. Sometimes that's called the Commonwealth period. And so you have about 11, 12 years in which the English are kind of wrestling of whether they can actually survive without a monarchy. And finally, in 1660, they decided, no, we can't, and they bring back the monarchy. So it's a period of time in which a lot of stuff is going on politically. But because of the era that we're in, when things are going on politically, things are also going on religiously. So let's go back to then the beginning of this period. The Parliament and the king are at war. The Parliament is motivated by constitutional and religious concerns. And so we have the Parliament deciding that they need to take action to correct religion in England. Now, a part of their thinking on this score was political, and it had to do with the Scots. You remember the Scots kind of started this whole thing, but they're not a part of the Civil War. They're a separate kingdom. But the Parliament worked on an agreement with the Scots called the Solemn League and Covenant. There's that word again. Solemn League and Covenant. The Scots would help the parliamentary side if the parliamentary side would agree to reform their church in a way that was congruent with the Scots. As a matter of fact, this is how they put it, namely, Parliament promised, quote, the reformation of religion in the kingdoms of England and Ireland in doctrine, worship, discipline, and government, according to the word of God and the example of the best reformed churches. Now, that example would include the Netherlands, it would include Zurich, it would include Geneva, but I think from the Scottish point, it especially would include Scotland. So, 1643, Parliament summons a big meeting, an assembly of clergymen and laymen to work on these issues, that is, to reform the Church of England. They basically set up a committee that would determine who it is that should be invited. They wanted a couple of members from every shire and from every borough and so forth. The king ordered that no supporters of him should show up, as a result of which, when this assembly came together, it was really the Puritan wing of the Church of England. They're the ones who showed up at the assembly. They met in Westminster. Today, that's a part of Greater London, but in those days, it was separate from London. And it's kind of like a few miles outside of London, and that's where Parliament met. So that's where also this religious assembly met. It's known in history as the Westminster Assembly. It had about 150 members. 30 of them were laymen. 10 of them were from Scotland. Only about half of them ever showed up. But when they started to meet, they really met. And over the next 6-7 years, they met in almost 1,200 sessions. And every session lasted about a day, and every session was opened with a sermon. So that's a lot of sermons as well. But at any rate, they were very active in doing what the Parliament had said they should do, that is, reform the church in its doctrine, its discipline, and all the other things, worship and the other things that would make for a pure church. Now, this assembly demonstrated pretty early that although the Puritan movement generally was agreed on what they did not like about the Church of England, they were not agreed on what they thought should replace the Church of England. And so a division emerged, and anachronistically, we label the sides the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists, and I'll talk about that here in just a little moment. But the Presbyterians were in the majority, and so the documents and decisions that they made turned out to be characteristic of Presbyterianism. And now one of these things some of your listeners might be familiar with, and that is that that name Westminster often gets attached to Presbyterian institutions, colleges, seminaries, publishing houses. When you hear the word Westminster, if it has a church origin, that probably means Presbyterian. And the big documents coming out of the Westminster Assembly, theologically speaking, are the two Westminster Catechisms, the larger and the shorter catechism, the larger for pastors in order to teach their congregations good Presbyterian doctrine, and the shorter to be used in the instruction of children. And then also the Westminster Confession. And this Westminster Confession is one of the most important documents defining historically what it means to be a Presbyterian. Now, they didn't do this all overnight. The Westminster Confession was finally agreed upon in 1646, and they turned it over to Parliament, and Parliament said, you need to have Bible passages. So they took it back and they put the Bible passages in to prove their particular doctrines, and then it was approved by Parliament. It was also sent off to Scotland, and the Scottish Church approved it as well. So it becomes an important confessional statement of what it means to be Presbyterian. Now, the Congregationalists who were there agreed with almost everything in the Westminster Confession, except about how the church should be organized and governed. And so later on, the Congregationalists adopted their own version of the Westminster Confession. This was in 1658. It was the Savoy Declaration. And even Baptists at this time, and I'll explain also how they come out of this movement, they agreed with a lot of what was in the Westminster Confession. So they adopted their own Baptist version of this many, many years later. So it's a really important document in terms of defining what a large consensus of English Protestants, the Puritan wing of the Church of England, actually believed. Now, it's not going to surprise any of your listeners if I categorize it as Reformed. It's Reformed Protestantism, and that means you'll have good Protestant stuff in there, like the biblical authority, sola scriptura, like justification by faith alone, like the propitiatory sacrifice of Christ for the sins of mankind. All of that's in there. But you will also get double predestination, that is, that God chose from all eternity for reasons of his own, some to be saved and others to be damned. You also get covenant theology. We talked about that a couple of episodes ago, where the idea that God originally had a way of people being in the right relationship with him. He had a covenant with Adam and Eve based upon works because of sin. That covenant failed, so he established another covenant, this covenant based upon faith and commitment to God on account of the saving work of Christ. That's in the Presbyterian Westminster Confession. You also get Sabbatarianism, the idea that the obligations from the Old Testament regarding the seventh day, the Sabbath, have been transferred in the New Testament to Sunday. That's also a part of the Westminster Confession. And then, as you might expect if it's Presbyterian, the Westminster Confession, as well as other documents at the Westminster Assembly, actually prescribe a Presbyterian form of church government. Now, we've talked about this a little bit before, but I thought it might be smart for us to just kind of review what that means. What is a Presbyterian form of church government? Basically, what the Presbyterian form is this, that in a geographic area, all the congregations have their pastors and their elders, who then get together in a kind of, well, a big committee called a presbytery in this geographic area, representatives of congregations, and that is kind of the key governmental agency. In other words, if there's going to be an examination of somebody for the ministry, or the ordination of somebody for the ministry, or an adjudication dealing with a doctrinal or a disciplinary matter in the congregation, the presbytery would make that decision, and that decision would be binding upon the congregations in that district, that area, covered by the presbytery. Now, when you have a Presbyterian system imposed upon an entire nation, say like Scotland, well, then there are going to be regional assemblies. And if necessity mandated, you could also have a national assembly. And the national assembly would consist of representatives from the presbyteries. And of course, the presbyteries are representatives from the congregations. So in a certain way, in a Presbyterian system, power flows upward from the congregations, presbytery, national assembly, but decisions flow downward. In other words, the national assembly would make the final decision regarding doctrine or practice. That, in turn, would become binding upon the presbyteries, and that, in turn, would become binding upon the congregations in the Presbyterian system. So this was the form of church government that at Westminster, the divines, the clergymen, and the lay elders thought was biblically mandated and should be established for England, kind of in parallel with what was going on in Scotland. So these Westminster documents are characteristic of a Presbyterian system in church. Now, the question you might have is, well, then did England become a Presbyterian country? And the answer is no. The Independents or Congregationalists, they go by both names. In this period, they're often called Independents, but they become the Congregationalists. They rejected a Presbyterian form of church government. They held that every local congregation should itself run its own affairs. I'll say a little bit more about them in a second. But so that's why they disagreed with the Westminster Assembly. They thought you should have, we'll call it congregational sovereignty. They should cooperate, they should work with others, but the decision-making would be in the hands of the local congregation. Now, they're a minority in the Westminster Assembly, but it turns out that in the army, they are a majority. Now, during the Civil War, you have to look at two kind of institutions. There's the Parliament, which has declared war and kind of runs the war, and then the army, which wins the war. And in the army, it's the Independents that are the dominant force. Furthermore, when finally the army gets tired of the poor performance by the Parliament, they actually take over the government, and one of the generals emerges as their strong man and leader, and that is Oliver Cromwell. Probably some of your listeners have heard of Cromwell. He's an independent. And as a matter of fact, they had kind of a constitution for Cromwell. And in this constitution, Cromwell and the army specified religious liberty. And here's what they said. Such as profess faith in God by Jesus Christ, though differing in judgment from the doctrine, worship, or discipline publicly held forth, shall not be restrained from, but shall be protected in, the profession of the faith and the exercise of their religion. So we're getting some of the first instances of religious liberty emanating from all places, the army, and from the strongman ruler of England in this period, Oliver Cromwell. So the Westminster Assembly stuff is not a dead letter, but it's never practically imposed upon all of England.
And we can do more on the Westminster Assembly and what happens after that, after we take a quick break. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
At Concordia University, Wisconsin, we believe you were created for a reason, to use your God-given gifts to help others, to live a life of self-sacrifice in a me-first world, to live a life that's uncommon. Whether you're taking one of 50-plus online programs or learning with us in person on the shores of Lake Michigan, you'll be equipped to make an uncommon impact. Learn more at cuw.edu. Concordia University, Wisconsin. Live uncommon.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about the Puritan movement, the Civil War, the Westminster Assembly, a lot of drama that happens at this time, a lot of different church, familiar names of churches showing up at this point. So what else happens with the Westminster Assembly and the fallout of that in the Church of England?
Okay, well, because of this large measure of religious liberty, the various tendencies of Puritanism start to manifest themselves institutionally. So on the one hand, you have the Presbyterians, and the Presbyterians basically are strongly committed to a national church. Everybody belongs to the national church. They're baptized as babies and so forth. Now, they still have to acknowledge the true faith and they have to live like Christians when they become adults, but they're members of the church. The independents slash congregationalists, they had a different view. They thought that, yeah, you should be baptized as a baby, but when you became an adult, you'd better get with the program and you'd better be able to tell how God was at work in your life through law, gospel, sanctification. In other words, give an oral commitment of your own personal faith and your walk as a Christian. And that became a condition for communicant membership. So if you were baptized as a baby, but at some point when you became an adult, you had to own the covenant. You had to make this personal commitment and demonstrate that to the other members of the church, so that the congregation in a particular area did not include everybody as adult members, but only those who publicly were willing to commit to this commitment. And that group then would become the church in a particular place. Now, here I'm going to give a little parenthesis. Though the Presbyterians dominate England, in New England, it's the independents slash congregationalists who dominate. And so in New England, in Massachusetts and Connecticut, a congregationalist polity was established so that in every town in New England, you'd have a church. Everybody would have to go to that church, but only some would be adult full communicant members of that church. So Presbyterian is the strongest in England. Congregationalism is the strongest in New England, and that's where in America we get the origins of Congress. But something else happens because some of the independents start rethinking this whole thing. And if they say, if what's really important is the work of the Spirit in your life on the basis of which you can commit to Christianity, then baby baptism is probably not all that important. And among these, there were some who took the next step out of independence, out of congregationalism, to become Baptists. The first instance that we have of this actually goes way back to the period of James I. One of those, you know, remember how the Pilgrims were a separatist congregation and they went over to the Netherlands. Well, there was another separatist congregation that about the same time went over to the Netherlands. They settled in Amsterdam, and their leader was a guy by the name of John Smith, or sometimes Smythe. And he's thinking through this. If the church is to consist of real believers only, then the sacraments belong to those real believers only. And therefore, baptism should follow faith, should follow the work of the Spirit in a person's life, not precede it. And so we have in Amsterdam a group of English independents who, under the leadership of John Smythe, embrace believer baptism. Now, Smythe looked around and couldn't find any pure church in which he could be baptized, so he rebaptized himself. And then he baptized the other members of his church. Now, he died in 1612. Some of his members actually ended up joining the Mennonite Church in the Netherlands. Others came back to London. And in 1612, we get the first Baptist congregation established in London, 1612. And from this, other churches came in due course. Now, one of the odd things about Smythe was the fact that he was Arminian in his theology. He did not accept double predestination. So the first Baptists are known as general Baptists. That means they believe Christ died for everybody. The particular Baptists arose in the 1630s when, again, another one of these independents decided that believer baptism was correct, but that he was a Calvinist, so believers' baptism, these guys became the particular Baptists. So we have a handful of Baptists before the Civil War. Probably at the time of the Civil War, you had maybe 50 Baptist congregations. But under the conditions of the Army, Independence, Cromwell, they grow. And there are about 250 congregations of Baptists coming out of the Independence Congregationalist movement by the time that Civil War is over. So we have now a flourishing proliferation of different forms of Christianity. And there's one more that we need to mention, and these are the Quakers. Now, again, if you think of how we're going here, Presbyterians, kind of everybody's in unless you show that you deserve to be kicked out. Congregationalists, well, you're not really in unless you can demonstrate the work of the Spirit. Baptists, well, you're not really in unless you can demonstrate the work of the Spirit commitment and then get baptized. There are still others who separate the work of the Spirit even more from the means of grace. And among them, the big name is George Fox. Now, Fox was a weaver and he was apprenticed as a shoemaker. He's not particularly well educated, but he was very concerned with religion. He was much oppressed by interior struggles, looking for certainty of forgiveness and salvation. He went around England trying to find the right church until in 1647, he gained a kind of certainty by deciding to rely not on anything outside of himself, but on the inner light of Christ alone, the inner light of Christ. And he believed that everybody had this, and so they just simply had to kind of listen to what Christ was saying to them personally. Now, he's still Trinitarian, he still believes in Jesus as the Savior and so forth, but the access to that was through the work of the Spirit personally in his life. And he was open to visions, or what he called openings. A few years later, he had a vision on Pendle Hill of all kinds of people dressed in white coming to the Lord. And this kind of was the signal that he should go around preaching and gather up the converts who likewise then would go out preaching. So he began to think of himself and his followers as a prophet. And so he went around and he converted people. The Spirit could work wherever it wanted to. So he's very egalitarian. Anybody can preach, no matter what social rank. Women could preach. It really didn't matter. The Spirit would work where he wanted to. This meant he didn't care about the social hierarchy. He didn't tip his hat. He didn't speak the right language to the authorities. And so he's in trouble all the time. His people are all persecuted. But for his sake and his group, he had an extremely important convert by the name of William Penn. And William Penn became a Quaker right in the early 1660s, and it was Penn who really kind of saved the day for the Quakers and established Pennsylvania as a Quaker colony, a place of refuge for them and other religious dissidents.
That sounds like a fun theme for the next episode.
Ooh.
The question is, will we get to have oatmeal with that episode?
We can have oatmeal with our coffee.
That's true.
Breakfast time.
Oh, man, this is so fascinating.
I know. It's very helpful, too.
Yes. Learning a lot about, the origin of all of them. denominations, the Protestant denominations. Our guest today, the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, thank you so much for enlightening us with your wisdom today.
Well, you're very welcome. I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.